Okay. I want to start today with a fact that honestly sounds like it shouldn't be true. I mean, it sounds like a physics mistake.
I love those. Let's hear it.
So, you know the turbine blades in a modern jet engine?
Right, the high pressure turbine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The one spinning at thousands of RPM,
Yeah.
literally keeping you in the air. Well, in the hottest part of that engine, those blades are operating in an environment that is actually hotter than the melting point of the metal they're made of.
It is mind-bending, isn't it? If you took a normal piece of that alloy, even a really high-tech nickel superalloy, and just tossed it in there, it would just turn into a puddle.
Exactly. So how do they survive? How do we not fall out of the sky?
It all comes down to structure. Those blades aren't just cast metal, they are single crystals.
Right.
They are grown as one continuous, unbroken lattice of atoms, and that structure completely changes the rules of how the material behaves under stress and heat.
And that is exactly what we are unpacking today for you. We are doing a deep dive into the geometry of deformation.
It's such a fascinating topic. We're basing this deep dive on Chapter 6, which is called Deformation and Texture, from Boetius' book on the geometry of crystals and phase transformations.
Now, I'll be honest with you. I opened this chapter and it is dense.
Yeah, it is.
It's heavy on the math, lots of Greek letters, but our mission today is to translate that. We're going to start microscopic, talking about how a single crystal stretches and slides, and then we're going to zoom out.
Right, to see how those tiny movements determine the macroscopic properties of things you use every day. The steel in your car or the aluminum in the soda can sitting on your desk.
It's really the story of how order emerges from the chaos of smashing metal.
Beautifully put.
So let's start at the very bottom, the single crystal. When I think of deformation, I instinctively think of stretching a rubber band. You pull it, it gets longer. Is that what's happening to a crystal?
Not quite. That's actually a common intuition trap. A rubber band stretches because the polymer chains inside are uncoiling. It's like straightening out a bowl of spaghetti. But in a metal crystal, you have a rigid grid of atoms, a lattice. If you pull it, the atoms can't just drift apart.
Because if they drifted apart, the bonds would break and the metal would snap.
Exactly. So to change shape without breaking, the atoms have to slide. Think of a deck of playing cards.
Right, okay.
If you push the top card forward, it slides over the one beneath it. That's what metallurgists call slip. Whole planes of atoms sliding over one another.
Okay, I can visualize the deck of cards sliding, but here's my issue with that analogy. If I'm pulling a metal bar in a testing machine, I'm pulling it lengthwise. I'm not pushing it sideways like I would a deck of cards. How does a pulling force turn into a sliding force?
That is the million-dollar question. It comes down to resolution.
Resolution, like screen resolution.
No, resolving forces. It's geometry. Even if you pull straight up and down, that force splits up inside the crystal depending on the angle of the atom planes.
Okay, this is the math part, right?
It's a little bit of math, but it's crucial. Imagine you have a tensile force, let's call it F, but the slip plane, that layer in the deck of cards, is sitting at an angle inside the crystal. We need to know how much of that force is actually pushing along the plane.
So we need to know the angle.
Two angles, actually. You have the angle between the pulling force and the normal to the plane, that's called phi, and then you have the angle between the pulling force and the actual direction of the slip. That's lambda.
And this leads us to the Schmid factor. I saw this term all over the source text.
Yes, equation 6.1 in the book. The resolved shear stress, tau, equals the force divided by area multiplied by cosine phi times cosine lambda.
Okay.
That geometric part, the cosine phi times cosine lambda, is the Schmid factor.
So in plain English, what is this factor actually telling us?
It's a measure of leverage. It tells us how easy it is to make the crystal slip. And the maximum value it can possibly have is 0.5.
Which happens when?
That happens when both angles are exactly 45 degrees.
Which makes sense, right? If the plane is perfectly flat at 90 degrees, you're just pulling the atoms apart, not sliding them.
Right.
And if it's vertical at 0 degrees, you're just pulling parallel to them. But at 45 degrees,
You have maximum shearing leverage. It's the weakest orientation for the crystal. This is why, if you pull a single crystal of metal, it doesn't just get uniformly longer, it actually forms these visible bands and steps on the surface because specific planes are sliding at that 45-degree angle.
but here's the problem. Real crystals are 3D. They
Oh.
have tons of planes. In a cubic crystal, you've got planes going everywhere.
Oh, absolutely.
So how do you know which one is going to slip first? Do you have to calculate this Schmid factor for every single one?
You could, but crystallographers are clever. they came up with a shortcut called Dial's Rule.
I really like this part. It felt like a cheat code.
It totally is a cheat code. It uses stereographic projection. Basically, a map of the crystal's directions flattened into a triangle. You plot the direction you're pulling the tensile axis inside a shaded triangle on the map.
And the rule just tells you where to look.
Right. If your force is in the shaded triangle, the active slip system, the one that will actually move first, corresponds to the adjacent triangles on the map. You don't need to run the math for all 24 possible systems. The geometry of the map just hands you the answer.
That is so elegant. But okay, let's say the slip starts. The deck of cards is sliding. What happens to the crystal's orientation? Does it stay the same?
No, and this is the twist, quite literally. The crystal rotates.
Why does it rotate?
Well, imagine you have that deck of cards again, and you slide the top half to the right. The overall shape of the deck creates a slant, right?
Right.
Now, imagine you are pulling on the ends of a crystal. If the ends are free to move sideways, which we call unconstrained deformation, the axis you're pulling along effectively rotates towards the slip direction.
Okay, that makes sense for unconstrained. But in the real world, usually we're gripping the metal, like in a testing machine or a massive rolling mill. The ends can't move sideways.
Exactly. The machine holds the sample rigid. So if the overall sample shape can't tilt, the crystal lattice itself has to rotate inside the metal to accommodate the slip.
Wait, so the atoms themselves are pivoting?
Yes. The entire lattice rotates. And this is crucial because this rotation is the seed of texture.
Texture. That's a word we're going to hear a lot today.
It's the bridge to the real world. Because of this rotation, the crystals inside a metal don't stay random. They start to line up with each other.
Before we get to the big picture of texture, though, there was a specific example in the source that I found really helpful for visualizing this mechanism. Example 6.2, martensite.
Ah, yes. The phase transformation from austenite to epsilon martensite.
Now, usually when I hear phase transformation, I think of ice melting into water. Correct. But this is solid to solid, right?
Correct. Austenite has a face-centered cubic structure. It's nice and symmetrical. Martensite is hexagonal, close-packed. To get from one to the other, you don't need to melt it down and reform it. You just need to shear it.
The source was very specific about this mechanism. It said it involves a displacement on every second close-packed plane.
Right. So imagine a stack of atomic layers. You leave the first one alone. You shove the second one. You leave the third one alone. You shove the fourth one.
That's like a rhythm.
Exactly. That regular rhythmic shifting changes the stacking sequence from cubic to hexagonal.
And we can actually calculate the strain of that shift.
We can, and the source walks right through it. You take the displacement, which is a fraction of the lattice parameter, specifically a over 6 in the 1-1-2 direction, and you divide it by the distance between the planes.
And the result was 1 over the square root of 2.
Which is roughly 0.707. That is a massive shear strain. It's a huge shape change for a solid crystal.
And here's where the Schmid factor comes back, right?
Yeah.
Because there isn't just one way to do this.
Correct. There are 12 different variants, 12 different ways the crystal could shear to become martensite. But if you apply stress, you bias the system. The variant that actually forms is the one where the stress interacts most favorably with that specific shear direction.
So the stress essentially picks the winner.
Exactly. It wakes up the specific variant that complies best with the geometry of the force you're applying.
Okay, so we've got slip, we've got rotation, we've got phase changes happening based on stress. Now let's zoom out. Because as you said earlier, most things aren't single crystals.
No, not at all. If you look at the steel in your car door, it's polycrystalline. It's made of millions and millions of tiny individual grains.
And when we start, those grains are just pointing in random directions, right?
Ideally, yes. But remember what we said about rotation. When you process that steel, say you run it through giant industrial rollers to flatten it into a sheet, you are applying massive force.
So every single one of those millions of grains is experiencing that constrained deformation we talked about.
Yes. And so every single one of them starts to rotate. And they don't just rotate randomly. They tend to converge on stable orientations. They all start pointing the same way.
And that alignment is what we call crystallographic texture.
Exactly. It's important to note it's not texture like rough or smooth on the surface. It's the internal alignment of the atomic lattice.
The source uses this shorthand code to describe these textures. It looked like brackets and numbers. Curly brackets, HKL. And then angle brackets UVW. It honestly looked like a computer password.
It can definitely be intimidating to look at, but it's really just a coordinate system. To visualize it, think of a boat floating on a river.
Okay, I'm picturing a boat.
The HKL part in the curly brackets, That tells you which crystal plane is lying flat, like the bottom of the hull sitting on the water. That represents the plane parallel to the sheet surface.
Got it. Hull on the water.
And the UVW in the angle brackets. That tells you which crystal direction is pointing towards the bow of the boat, the direction you're traveling, or in the metal's case, the rolling direction.
That helps a lot, actually. So it's literally telling you how the crystal is sitting inside the sheet of metal.
Yes. And there are famous ones that pop up all the time. The source mentions the brass texture, which is HKLL110 and UVW112, or the copper texture.
And the cube texture. That one seems pretty easy to remember. 100 and 001.
Right. That's like a box sitting perfectly square with the world, hull flat on the water, bow pointing straight ahead. It often happens when you heat the metal up and let it recrystallize.
Then there's the Gauss texture, 110 and 001.
The Gauss texture is a celebrity in the metallurgy world. We'll get to why in a minute, but it is incredibly important for electrical applications.
Okay, so we know these textures exist,
yeah,
but you can't see atoms with your eyes. How do we know they are aligned? How do we visualize this completely invisible structure?
We need a map. The classic way to do that is the pole figure.
So imagine a circle, right?
A circle that basically represents the globe of orientations. If you have a perfectly random sample and you use X-rays to detect the crystal planes, you'll get dots scattered everywhere on that circle. It looks like snow static on an old TV.
But if it's textured?
The dots clump together, you get hot spots on the map. If you see a dense cluster of dots at the top and bottom, you know, aha, all the crystals have rotated so their poles are pointing exactly that way.
The source actually showed these comparison images, figure 6.5. The random one is just noise. But the textured one has these very clear, dense regions.
And we can flip that logic, too. We can use an inverse pole figure. Instead of plotting the crystal poles relative to the sample, we plot the sample directions like the rolling direction relative to the crystal axis.
So it's just a change of perspective, like looking at the car from the driver's seat versus looking at the driver from the street.
Exactly. And the measurement tech for this has gotten really good. We used to just use X-ray diffraction, which gives you an average over a fairly large area. Now we use EBSD, electron backscatter diffraction.
That involves the scanning electron microscope, right?
Yes. You shoot an electron beam at a single microscopic grain. The electrons bounce off the atomic planes inside and create these beautiful geometric patterns. They're called channeling patterns.
Figure 6.7 in the notes shows one. It honestly looks like a kaleidoscope.
It really does. And a computer can read that kaleidoscope pattern and tell you exactly to within a fraction of a degree how that specific grain is oriented.
But there's a catch with pole figures.
There is a catch. Pole figures are 2D, but orientation is 3D. A pole figure is basically a shadow. It tells you where a pole is pointing, but it doesn't tell you how the crystal is rotated around that specific pole.
So we're missing information.
Right. To get the full picture, the ultimate map, we need the orientation distribution function, or ODF.
And this is where we meet the Euler angles.
The three bungee Euler angles.
Yep.
Phi 1, capital Phi, and Phi 2.
This sounded a lot like flight dynamics to me when I was reading it.
It is very similar to pitch, yaw, and roll. It's essentially a recipe for rotation. It says, start with the crystal perfectly aligned with the sample. First, rotate it by phi 1 about the vertical axis. That's your yaw.
Okay.
Then tilt it by capital Phi. That's your pitch. Then spin it again by phi 2. That's your roll.
So if you do those three specific moves, you match the crystal's actual position in the metal.
Exactly. And because we have three variables, we can't plot this on a flat piece of paper. We have to plot it in a cube.
A 3D cube.
Imagine a box. The width is phi 1, the height is capital Phi, the depth is phi 2. Every single point inside that 3D box represents a specific, unique orientation of a crystal.
So if I have a perfectly random material, the box is just filled with a uniform fog of dots.
Yes. But if I have a strong texture, like that Gauss texture or cube texture we talked about, the dots will bunch up into tight clouds or even tubes running through the box. It is the absolute most rigorous way to map the material's internal architecture.
Okay, we've gone very deep into the geometry here. We're inside a 3D Euler cube. I want to pull us back out to the real world.
Sounds good.
Why does any of this matter to the listener? Why should you care if the atoms in your soda can are aligned?
Well, the soda can is actually the perfect example. Think about how a can is made. It starts as a completely flat sheet of aluminum. Then a punch slams into it and deep draws it into a cup shape in a fraction of a second.
It's extreme deformation. The metal really has to flow.
It does. Now, imagine if the texture is wrong. Imagine the crystals are aligned, so they stretch really easily in one direction. Remember our friend, the Schmid factor.
Right.
But they resist stretching in the other direction.
The cup wouldn't be round anymore.
Exactly. You get a manufacturing defect called earing. The rim of the can becomes wavy. It gets these high spots and low spots that literally look like little ears, and that ruins the seal for the lid.
So if you're a manufacturer making a billion cans a year,
you have to trim those ears off. That's wasted metal. Or worse, the metal tears during the punch because it couldn't flow where the machine wanted it to. So we designed the texture of the aluminum on purpose to avoid that.
What about cars? You mentioned car doors earlier.
Same exact principle. A car door has really complex curves. You're stamping a flat sheet of steel into a complex 3D shape. If you don't control the texture beforehand, the steel splits in the press. You literally can't make the part.
You also mentioned transformers earlier.
Yeah.
And the Gauss texture.
This is a huge one for global energy efficiency. Inside a power transformer, you have iron cores. The magnetization cycles through those cores 60 times a second.
Okay.
Now, magnetism isn't neutral. It prefers to travel along certain crystal directions, the easy axes. If the crystals in the iron are random, the magnetic field has to fight its way through the hard directions. That creates resistance. Resistance creates heat. Heat is energy loss.
So you're just wasting electricity?
Lots of it. But if you process the iron to have a very sharp Gauss texture, the 110001 we mentioned, you line up all those easy magnetic axes with the direction of the magnetic field.
The atoms literally pave the road for the magnetism.
They do. It minimizes the loss. It makes the entire power grid more efficient. All because we figured out how to make the microscopic crystals rotate into that specific formation.
That is wild. We started this conversation talking about a single slip plane in a turbine blade. Basically, geometry on the atomic scale.
Yeah.
And we've ended up with mass-produced car parts and the efficiency of the power grid.
It really shows that there is no such thing as just a simple piece of metal. Every piece of metal has a history, and that history is written in the alignment of its crystals.
And the connecting link is really just that geometry, how things move and rotate under stress.
Absolutely.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with a thought. We've talked today about how processing, rolling, stamping, deep drawing creates texture. It aligns the grains. And that alignment completely changes the properties. Mm. So we aren't just shaping the shape of the metal when we work it. We are fundamentally organizing its internal architecture.
That's very true. We are rearranging the lattice itself.
So here is the question for you to mull over. Is it possible to design a processing method that creates a texture so perfect, so uniformly aligned, that the material behaves exactly like a single crystal without actually being one? Can you imagine a world where we stamp out car frames or airplane parts that have the molecular perfection of a silicone wafer just by being better choreographers of that atomic rotation?
That is the holy grail of texture engineering right there. We are getting incredibly close with things like the Gauss texture, but perfect macroscopic alignment. That's the dream.
Something to think about the next time you look at a simple aluminum soda can on your desk. There is a whole lot of order in that chaos. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
It was a pleasure.
See you next time.